Hi everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comics, manga, graphic literature podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today are Mick and Andrew.
That's me, and also him.
And yes, me too.
Yes, one of them is Mick and one of them is Andrew. I'll leave it up to you, audience, to decide who is who.
Answers on a postcard to the usual address.
Which is your house, isn't it, Mick?
Do people still do postcards? Is that still a thing?
Don't know.
Or is it just something that gets shoddily put into a special edition of a game release?
Probably a game release. Probably something to do with Fallout.
And also, you have to pay microtransactions to access it, but yeah, it's in randomised loot boxes.
Yes. So how are you guys this week?
I mustn't grumble.
I must grumble, because that's kind of a big part of the show, is complaining about things. God, can you imagine if we did an episode of this where we just said nice things?
No, I cannot imagine that. My mind is actually rebelling against that.
The day that happens, the devil will be skating to work.
Yes.
I mean, saying that, I feel like it gives us a good lead into our first news story.
Yes.
Which I think can just be summed up with the phrase, Jesus Christ, Marvel.
Oh?
What have you done, you fools?
What did they do now?
So, pretty recently, it was New York Comic Con.
Yeah.
Over in that New York place, what they've got in America.
Yeah.
And as part of that, Marvel had a very special announcement to make.
Yay!
It's that they were going to do another one of their beloved corporate partnerships.
Okay.
Yay!
Because we all remember how much we loved the Western Union Bank comic.
Oh God, I forgot about that. Thank you for reminding me.
And the Lexus Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
That's right.
They did one of those for Guardians as well.
They've done them for everything.
Yes, they have.
So this time, they've got another fun all-ages comic in which the Avengers team up with the scientists of the Elite Nexus, who work for Northrom Grumman, one of the largest defense contractors in the world.
Whoa. Just whoa.
They did what
just,
now?
Just whoa. Whoa. And I know that was a little...
This is a comic saying, hey kids, it's super fun to work for people who sell weapons.
Whoa. I know Captain America was a soldier. And I know Tony Stark...
Give Rob a knock. I think he's caught in an infinite feedback loop.
Yeah, I know Captain America was a soldier, and I know Tony Stark did develop weapons, but that's no excuse.
Tony Stark did develop weapons, and then he realised, wait, it's bad to make things that kill people.
Huh. So hang on. You said you kind of put this in past tense.
Yes, I did.
Well, yes, because it turns out comic fans didn't agree that this was such a good idea.
Yes, the meltdown was just majestic to behold. Because possibly an even worse thing Marvel did was almost immediately on Twitter they posted, hey, what's your weirdest story from New York Comic Con? And just every single response was, I think it was the time Marvel tried to sell weapons to children. Yep, it was definitely that.
Ouch. Oh.
One of my favourite quotes is, I think it was a terrible idea to begin with to try to merge these two worlds, said someone who was dressed as the Marvel character Nick Fury. They saw the backlash and they shut it down.
They did, yes. Thankfully, Marvel have cancelled the deal. But apparently, it was... supposedly, it was purely Marvel's advertising department that came up with this and no one in the main company knew. Nope, definitely not.
Really? This has nothing to do with us.
And then they released an official statement saying, the activation with Northrop Grumman at New York Comic Con was meant to focus on aerospace technology and exploration in a positive way. However, as the spirit of that intent has not come across, we will not be proceeding with this partnership.
Exploration technology, then why not just contact Elon Musk and say, we want to do a partnership with SpaceX?
Yeah, it's almost somehow worse to like try and ignore the giant heavily armed elephant in the room.
Yeah.
No, I believe that heavily armed elephant has a name that you like, Andrew.
What, ancient psychic tandem war elephant?
Yes.
There are some excellent quotes. And it's clear that whoever wrote the article isn't shall we say, familiar with the world of comic fandom. Diana Murano, a New Yorker, was dressed as Harley Quinn, a character she described as Joker's girlfriend from DC Comics' Batman story. You know, just the one. And she said it was inappropriate for a company that makes weaponry to be promoted in a comic series. And then the gentleman who was accompanying Harley Quinn and dressed as a Star Wars-inspired character, Darth Omegus, said, "I want my fantasy to be my fantasy and my reality to be my reality. I don't want them crossing over and getting a sense that Donald Trump is going to pop up in my X-Men comic."
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear.
I mean, a man who's dressed as Darth Omegus accompanying Harley Quinn to a comic con, he's really nailed that one in his fantasy to be his fantasy, hasn't he?
Yep.
You know, I'm just sad that we're not going to get the future Spider-Man story where he just kind of picks up an AK-47 and guns down Kraven the Hunter and just says, "Oh my God, why haven't I been doing this all along? Guns are great."
Besides which, surely that's what the Punisher's there for.
Oh yeah, speaking of which, this is kind of the even worse part.
Oh yeah, because it wasn't bad enough.
Basically, this announcement came almost immediately after Marvel cancelled their Punisher event because of the Las Vegas shootings.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah.
Hmm. Strange how you can make such a wise decision immediately before such a foolish one.
Yeah, they have quite appropriately shot themselves in the foot.
In fact, this could be the first time that Marvel appear on the What Have DC Done Now webpage.
Yeah, I thought they should get a special guest edition.
the Marvel crossover, Marvel DC crossover that they didn't want.
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe Marvel is so obsessed with beating DC in everything. Like, even the horrific scandals. Like, no, we can do dumb stuff even better.
That might actually be the case. We don't know.
And the other thing I've just spotted towards the end of the article is a little sidebar with that links you to a gallery called The Marvel Age of Comics, 1961 to 1978 in pictures, which surely Marvel have already done.
Yeah, you'd think, because they work in comics. Which, correct me if I'm wrong on this, I'm not sure, but aren't comics mainly pictures?
They are, with some wordy bits over the top.
I learned something new today.
Yes, those bubbles are called wordy bits.
Anyway, moving on.
Wait.
Oh?
I just have one last bit that, Rob, you'll like.
Oh.
Because one of the other quotes on this is from Ruby Coetto, who is visiting with her daughters, and it begins, "As a mother,
oh God,
I'm not in favour of a weapons company sponsoring a Marvel comic." So that's it. Someone's spoken as a mother. That's why they shut it down, really. It's because someone said as a mother, so no, can't do it anymore.
The might of Mumsnet strikes again.
No, never mind Mumsnet. It's 1 million mums.
Maybe all 1 million of them were caught in the Mumnet.
Which was cast by Spider-Man, who, coincidentally, is Mrs. Coetta's daughter's favourite superhero.
Okay, good choice.
Because she likes how he saves people and tries to keep everyone safe.
I've just realised you could have Spider-Man with an AK-47 because he would be Ben Reilly, because Ben Reilly is psycho.
See, now I'm imagining more like the new and improved Spider-Mobile, which is just a tank.
Yes. Well, wasn't it actually a tank in, like, the toys that they put out?
Probably.
Almost certainly.
If Spider-Man can have a jet, he can have a tank.
See, I never understood why Spider-Man's got a tank when he, you know, he swings from building to building much faster than the tank can move.
Because kids buy things.
True. We mentioned not long ago that Taika Waititi is being selected, shall we say, to direct Akira by Warner Brothers,
the live action. Like all of us, Warner Brothers thought that what Akira needed was more light-hearted whimsy.
Yep. Well, he's actually commented in an interview, Taika Waititi has, that he is in negotiations with Warner Brothers about directing the live action Hollywood version of Akira, but he hasn't actually confirmed that he's signed on to direct the project. But he has said he's very passionate about Akira and that he isn't interested in remaking the animated movie. he actually wants to do adaptations of the original manga. And he also has said that he is actually looking at Asian teenagers. Quoting him directly, actually, Asian teenagers would be the way to do it for me, and probably, no, not like No Name, I mean sort of unfound, untapped talent. So, this makes me happy.
It was shortly after this statement that Warner Brothers exited negotiations.
Yes. You know it's going to happen. Warner Brothers are going to say, nope, nope, we don't want them anymore. It's supposed to be a Hollywood remake, you know? USA! USA!
You can have Michelle Yeoh and Daniel Day-Kim playing Mum and Dad, and that's it.
It's fine. We can get Garrett Dillahunt as his son, because he'll reveal he's actually like 1/16th Japanese. It's good enough for Johnny Depp in The Lone Ranger. It's good enough for this.
Yeah.
But also, it definitely wasn't good enough for Johnny Depp in The Lone Ranger.
No, it wasn't. Oh. But you just know it's going to happen now. You just know he's not going to be directing the movie, and he's not going to get his way. He's not going to have Asian actors. Especially teenage Asian actors.
There'll be some half-assed compromise where, you know, there's a couple of background artists who play sort of quirky characters that everybody will remember but don't play a huge part in the movie.
It's going to be that.
Oh, maybe they could get the cast of The Raid to stand around in the background again.
Possibly, yeah.
Just like Star Wars.
Yes. Or they're going to have the lead roles be white Hollywood actors, and they're going to have Asian girlfriends, because, hell, everybody wants an Asian girlfriend, don't they?
And their best friend can be Raj from The Big Bang Theory.
Yep.
Yep.
He's Asian.
And quite popular with a mainstream audience.
Actually, given his character that he plays in The Big Bang Theory, he could be one of the Asian girlfriends. So, yeah, it's still going to be set in America, they reckon. I actually want to draw a quick thing with Taika Waititi saying, you know, unfound, untapped talent from the Asian team, you know, from the acting world in like Japan and China and Korea and stuff like that. Yeah? I just want to draw attention to the fact that most Western people have no idea who these actors are in the first place. So saying, you know, unfound, untapped talent.
Yeah, so any Japanese actor.
Yes.
Of course, the other thing it does is it makes the film an administrative nightmare as they try and negotiate their way around Mr. Trump's ever-increasingly difficult immigration policies.
See, if I was in charge of casting...
Man. They have to shoot it in Japan because they're not allowed to emigrate any of the actors.
Yes. See, if I was gonna do this just to annoy people, the top executives in Warner Brothers, I would put cast as many of the male characters. I would choose as many actors whose names are Akira as well, and put them in those roles. Just to highlight the fact that Akira is a very common Japanese name. And I know we talked about that before, but I would literally do that if I had control of this.
They said I was mad to cast Dragon Ball creator Akira Toriyama as the main role in Akira, but I sure proved them right.
Exactly. Oh, what about Kurosawa?
Or just a skeleton on the back next to him.
Yes.
God, I feel like that's going to win some kind of art house festival award.
Probably
if you just got like a wizened old Japanese man screaming Tetsuo, and then it cuts to a skeleton, and then cuts back to him yelling Tetsuo even louder.
Yes. Oh, dear. The art house version of Akira is amazing.
Also, now that I think about it, that does kind of sound like a Taika Waititi film.
Exactly. Oh, so, yeah.
Right.
Moving on.
So, on to more serious news. An alleged art thief called Francesco Bove, who police claim stole approximately $239,000 worth of original art from Marvel Chief Creative Officer Joe Quesada, is awaiting extradition from New York to New Jersey.
Sorry, what?
Extradition from New York...
Yeah.
All the way to New Jersey following his arrest at his home in Brooklyn.
Hang on, so they want to take him from New York to New Jersey?
Yes.
And New Jersey is like, what, an hour away from New York? An hour and a half?
Yes.
So come on, we have to get on the special extradition subway.
Or the Tunnel of Shame, as it's known. Yes. So the story goes that Quesada hired Bove to repair some damage to his home that was caused by a broken water pipe, at which point Bove moved into the home without Quesada's knowledge or consent with his girlfriend, his unnamed girlfriend, which is a terrible shame, having to grow up with no name.
You thought long and hard about that joke, didn't you?
I did, yes. I've been working on that all day. I had to phone into the office and say, I won't be in today, I've got a joke to work on.
But I should never tell Mick that the Venture Bros already did that joke many years ago.
Yes, you shouldn't tell Mick that, Andrew.
Don't worry, he'll never find out.
So it was quite an elaborate deal. Police say that the miscreant covered the home security cameras with towels before moving in and taking the art. The squatting was discovered when Quesada's wife remotely checked the cameras and discovered they'd gone dark. After verifying that the cameras worked, the Quesadas confronted Bove, who they say then admitted he and his girlfriend had been living in the house. He was then promptly fired, and then they discovered...
Yeah, as you would be.
Yeah. It was then that they discovered some artwork was missing, including a portrait of Mrs. Quesada by an unnamed artist.
Do they not just name their children in America?
No. It's an administrative nightmare. I mean, hell, you've got to extradite people from New York to New Jersey. Can you imagine what it's like getting a birth certificate and a christening done?
I mean, instead of calling them unnamed, can not just call them John Doe or Jane Doe like they do in like the movies and TV?
I don't know. I mean, maybe that in itself would cause an equally huge amount of red tape. But
the situation I'm surprised doesn't happen more often is when they name the child Joe Quesada's wife, and then she doesn't go on to marry someone called Joe Quesada.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what a nightmare that would be.
Awkward when she does eventually marry. Do you, Joe Quesada's wife? Take this man.
Take Stephen Donaldson.
Take John Doe to be your anyway, back to the story. So Bove has admitted selling the art to various dealers in New York, but also claimed that Quesada had given him the art because it was damaged by water. Apparently $5,000 worth of art was recovered from one unspecified gallery. Quesada has at this point declined to comment for the story.
But when he does, it's probably going to be, well, I did steal Spider-Man's marriage, so fair enough.
Yeah.
True.
Because for the reminder, it's all Joe Quesada's fault that Spider-Man isn't married to Mary Jane Watson.
Well, in that case, he deserves everything that's coming to him.
My sentiments exactly, but no, not really. Don't take that seriously, people.
No. New listeners may need to be warned that we occasionally say things that should be deemed tongue-in-cheek.
Which is unfortunate because it's the internet and everything you say is taken incredibly literally.
Yes.
Satire is a thing.
Well, it used to be, Rob. It used to be.
Yeah, but that was ancient Greek mythology.
Or the 80s.
Hey, what? Hey?
Or the 80s.
There were goat boys in the 80s?
No, there was satire in the 80s.
Ah, you're talking about spitting image and that?
Yeah.
I'm starting to think this joke doesn't have legs.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. It so doesn't. Anyway.
Shall I do some more news?
Yes.
And unusually, on a comic-themed podcast, it refers to Britain, as in the United Kingdom.
That magical faraway land.
As in that bit that's desperately trying not to be part of Europe, maybe. So the news is that in January's X-Men Gold Annual number one, the British X-Men team Excalibur are reuniting with a cover by Excalibur's co-creator Alan Davis.
Okay, so Excalibur as in Kitty Pryde and Nightcrawler and Captain Britain and I've forgotten the rest of them.
Captain Britain, who's rocking a sweet beard now, I notice.
Well, why not? He actually looks more like Captain Viking.
Oh, wasn't that knockoff Phoenix, whatever her name is, part of Excalibur as well?
It doesn't actually go into too much detail as to what the lineup is. It mentions Mark, Leah, and Aletha have painstakingly put together a love letter to Excalibur and a classic series we're all still talking about.
Really?
Apparently. We?
Yeah. Well, we are now.
Yeah, we are now.
We are. And why was maybe a bad idea to have a story about a comic book series that none of us have read or know anything about, really?
No, I've read some issues of Excalibur, but not many.
All it says is, this is a one-off story featuring the Excalibur team with the books lineup, which happens to feature many Excalibur alums.
See,
Marvel also teases a new Braddock Bundle of Joy.
A what?
A new Braddock Bundle of Joy, referring to the child, held by Megan in the new cover. And it's the fact that there's a cover to accompany the article that is where the podcast format really falls down.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it's basically like the one Excalibur cover that people know, only now Captain Britain has a beard.
Yeah.
This is true.
And Megan's holding a baby. Anyway, X-Men Gold Annual number 1 is scheduled to debut in January.
Which I'm sure is very exciting for Excalibur fans, but also not, because Mark Guggenheim is a terrible writer, so...
Also, are there Excalibur fans?
Probably.
Hey, it's the comic book that we're all talking about.
We are. We are saying it right now with our mouths.
Exactly.
Did you not listen to the earlier part of the news piece?
I kind of drifted in and out. You said Excalibur, and at that point I lost interest. As soon as I realised you weren't talking about King Arthur's swords or magic in any way, I started drifting in and out.
No. Although the comments section of the article, it's clear we are not the only ones talking about it. Fantastic. I wish this was more than a one-shot. We need Excalibur. Need, mark you. We need Excalibur back, which was agreed and seconded. So, you know.
Agreed and seconded.
Well, there you have it.
There's some love out there.
No, that's not love. That's just three people who voted for Brexit.
And I can tell you that the comments on this article in favour of the return of Excalibur number in the low teens.
They're just all people who voted for Brexit.
No, it's not.
Is it not?
That's assuming that Excalibur is for people from Britain, when in fact it's one of my favourite comedy, well, unintentional comedy moments. Of American people trying to understand what Britain is.
Oh, yes. God, yes. I forgot all about that.
Don't forget to pick up next week's exciting issue where Captain Britain drinks some tea.
And then goes
and
to play.
His arch nemesis, the Cockney.
No, they have to take a break at 4 for cricket and cucumber sandwiches.
I bet there will be at least one panel in this Excalibur comic where someone yells, "Call blimey, Gov."
Oh, yeah, it's not an Excalibur comic unless that happens at least once an issue.
We assume.
I've read some of the Excalibur comics and that happens more often than you think. It's not exactly call blimey, Gov, but something along those lines.
Strike a light.
Stone the crows, it's the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. I don't Adam and Eve it.
Not me, down with a feather.
The thing that I found hilarious was the fact that one of the Excalibur stories was set in kind of the north of England, but everyone still sounded like a Cockney, and they were saying stuff like that.
Because of course it was.
Well, that's because they think there's only two types of British accent. There's cultured villainy and Cockney.
Yeah, it's amazing how much cultured villainy sounds like the Queen's English.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, basically Excalibur is an entire series that's that one episode of Toast of London. It goes to the East End, and it's like, it's still Victorian Britain.
As soon as you said it, I knew exactly the episode you were talking about, and you're right. Oh, have you ever seen Toast of London, Mick?
No.
You should watch it.
Because Matt Berry irritates the hell out of me.
He might irritate you, but Toast of London is worth it. It's
I can only listen to that voice for about 10, 15 seconds, or however his longest scene was in the IT crowd.
Ah, that's a shame. So, yeah, on that note, shall we take a break?
Sounds like a plan.
We'll be back in a moment.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello, we're Literary Loitering from The Geek Show, and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literary Loitering.
This is Lizzie Boyle and Connor Boyle of Disconnected Press, and you're listening to The Geek Show.
The Geek Show is an independent podcast network, and to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop, and buy some of our lovely wares.
Welcome back. And now it's the part of the show where we read comics and tell you what we think. In some cases, so that you don't have to. First up this week, it's Rob.
Yes, and I have been reading an unusual thing for me. I have been reading The Autumn Lands, Tooth and Claw, and it got my attention because it had, like, on the cover of the first issue, it had a magic circle and a boar doing some kind of ancient mystic magic type thing. I thought, that looks unusual. Not seen that before. So I picked up the first five issues of it, and I have to say, I have enjoyed the first five issues immensely. All right, Autumn Lands is basically set... initially, the setup looks like it's just like a fantasy world where you have these anthropomorphized animals, and you basically, they've got their own society, they've got these floating cities, and in the floating cities live the higher animals, and down on the ground live the lower animals, like the wildebeests and stuff like that. And in the cities, the floating cities, everybody uses magic. They use a form of energy called Hatsas, which they channel and create miracles, effectively. And they were given this ability by the gods, who they pray to every day. They do all these various rituals, and it starts off with this dog, anthropomorphic dog called Dusty. His full name is kind of long, so I'm not going to go and try and pronounce it. But he's a young lad, and he's going out with his dad for the first time. And his dad is one of the majors, and he's a trader, and he's making a trade deal with the wildebeest down on the ground. And you find out just how kind of how stratified the various layers of society in this world are. And then the story moves on. You find that there's a council of majors, and they're all coming together because magic is disappearing. And they've basically been trying all sorts of ways to try and conserve the magic that they're using, because ultimately, if they don't have magic, then they can't do all sorts of things. And the tribes on the ground hate them. And if they are forced to survive on the ground, then they'll basically be killed. They'll basically be slaughtered by the tribes on the ground, because for centuries they've mistreated the tribes on the ground. So it's in their own interest to try and find a solution, try and find out some way of restoring magic. And this elderly female boar magician, she comes forward and she says, why don't we bring back the hero? I've found a way that we can possibly resummon the hero who opened the doors to magic in the first place and allowed us to have all of this. And if we summon him, we can ask him to open the doors to magic again, and then we can survive for longer. And obviously there's all sorts of conflict with that, and people, you know, some factions aren't happy with the idea, but she convinces a bunch of mages to join her, and they decide to summon the hero, but the summoning doesn't work the way they expect, and they eventually destroy a city, a floating city. Loads of people killed, everything like that. And what they summon is this furless being. Bipedal has a tendency to speak in a foreign language. When they understand what he's saying, he's swearing a lot, and he's killing wildebeests left, right, and centre since the wildebeest of it.
It's Porky Pig.
It's not Porky Pig. Oh. It's Master Sergeant Stephen T. Leroyd, who is part of the Coalition Forces. This is the hero they've summoned, and he's something that doesn't exist in this world. He's human.
Okay.
So Autumn Lands is actually set in the far future, after humans have basically all but killed themselves. And this is where the story gets interesting, because he's the only human there, or so he thinks. And he's trying to figure out what the hell's going on. He initially thinks he's having this weird, like a fevered cheese dream about talking animals and stuff like that. And he realizes very quickly that he's not having any kind of weird hallucination or dream. And so he's stuck there with all of these animals, trying to help them survive and fighting their war for them, which he never chose to do. And now he's also stuck with the task of being the hero, when all he is a soldier. And I've got to say, I'm loving the way the story is progressing. I'm loving the artwork. It's very, very brutal. It's very violent. Kurt Busiek is the guy who writes this, and he's done an amazing job on the first five issues. So I'm very, very, very much looking forward to how this story continues. You remember you were talking to me about Wayward?
Yeah.
And what drew you to Wayward? I kind of feel the same way about the Autumn Lands, Tooth and Claw. It's got my attention in much the same way that Wayward got your attention.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the issues, they've got this really nice, kind of two-page color image with a little story section, like the beginning of, say, a kid's book, where they have a picture with story section. And this story section is kind of, it's got this mythological feel to it. It's as if the story's being told from hundreds of years later, but it's actually dealing with events from the past. So everything kind of gets cast in that kind of story. What's the word I'm looking for? Everything gets cast
like a mythical.
Yeah, it gets cast more as a story, whereas what you're seeing is actually what actually happened. So it's got that nice bit to it as well. So yeah, the Autumn Lands, Tooth and Claw. If you like stuff like if you like your anthropomorphic animals, if you like stuff like Redwall and stuff like that, then you're going to love this.
I did like me some Redwall back in the day.
You're going to love the Autumn Lands then.
Ah, cool. I'm going to have to take that off you then.
I must admit, I did used to have a soft spot for Captain Carrot when he featured in the DC Universe.
Yeah. Actually, do you know what the Autumn Lands kind of remind me of, because it was set so far in the future? Remember the one from Improper Books? What was it? Mouse Pulp.
Yes, that's what it was reminding me of. Mulp.
Yeah, Mulp, that's it.
Because as soon as you said, it's like, it's in the future where humans have died off and been replaced by anthropomorphic animals. I knew I've heard something like that somewhere.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of that in terms of its setting.
Ah, nice.
Yeah. And Dusty, the young apprentice wizard dog boy, he's adorable. Because he's basically like a Staffordshire Terrier. But he's just so loyal and just so honest.
You see, there are phrases I only hear when I'm doing this podcast. And apprentice wizard dog boy is one of them.
I know. Anyway, who's next?
That would be me. So I'm going to describe a superhero to you. And I want you to see if you can guess what he's called. In the city, there is a multi-million pound industrialist who at night dons a disguise and strikes fear into the hearts of the criminals of his city. And he uses his vast fortune to produce all manner of gadgets to help him in this fight against crime.
Oh, well, that's obvious.
The Transvigilante.
Sorry?
It's obviously Marvel Comics Nighthawk.
I was going to say, I thought it was the Transvigilante. Is the transvestite vigilante?
Well, you're both wrong.
Is it Batman Well from The Tick?
No. It's the Black Sinister. Emerson Black is our vigilante. And when I read this comic, it was like someone had woken up and thought, I've just had an idea for the most twisted Elseworld version of Batman. So the Black Sinister is very much like Batman. His family own the industry that runs Coal City's economy. And at night he does don this mask and go out fighting crime. The thing is, it's not quite the justice that you get from The Dark Knight, because one, he doesn't actually care that much if the innocents that he's trying to protect get caught in the crossfire. And also, he's only really protecting them so that they can continue to be a source of cheap labour in his multi-million pound industrial empire.
That's horrible.
I know.
I love it.
But it's great fun.
Do you know the thing that strikes me is, this sounds like a very Monty Burns type superhero.
And it is. If you can imagine Monty Burns being Batman.
No, I can, because that happened in an episode of The Simpsons.
But the beauty is, he's also aided by his butler, Danby.
Again, the same episode of The Simpsons.
Who is completely and utterly at least as, if not more, barking than his master. But then there's also the similarities with Batman don't end there. There's also a fixation with his family, his parents. It's a slightly more dysfunctional version of the Wayne family, whereby the father was a very strict authoritarian who beat down on both Emerson and his mother. His mother has since passed on, and he kind of has this psychological subconscious relationship with her carrying on. Not in any sort of dark and mysterious way, but
nothing just, Freudian.
Nothing Freudian. Just almost in a sort of refusal to let her go. And there's also a sort of Dick Grayson subplot that picks up partway through as well. But again, with the same sort of twist.
Is this so, when he finds a worker in his factory who has a really great butt?
No, not quite. It's written by Kerr Andrews, and the artist is Troy Nixie, who some people may be familiar with his work on Lobster Johnson and directing Don't Be Afraid of the Dark. And it's a fun read. It's one of those comics where you'd have a look at it on the shelf and think, should I? Well, trust me, you probably should.
Excellent.
And in reference to your earlier comment, I'm going to award it 4 Nightwing butts.
That is a prestigious amount of rear-endage.
It is.
See, I can't award the Autumn Lands any Nightwing butts because humans don't exist. But if we're talking like Nightwing as in an owl, then it's definitely 4 Nightwing butts as well.
But I don't think owl buttockses have as much value as Dick Grayson's.
I think if I was sat there as a creator owner at Image Comics and I was reading a review of my comic and it awarded me 4 Nightwing butts, I think I'd be slightly more proud than if another review offered me 4 owl butts.
Well, they're still Nightwing butts, just not the same Nightwing.
Yeah. I'm not sure it's got the same.
All right, 4 Nightwing butts. Twisting my arm.
Andrew, what have you got?
Well, I've got another series from Image. I've read the first issue of Kill or Be Killed.
Oh, I've heard of this one.
Yep, it's a new series by Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. And it kicks off with mysterious vigilante in a hoodie and a red ski mask killing his way through a bunch of gangsters while kind of decrying the state the world is in. I like it because it kind of gets some topical stuff in, like, you know, big business controls the government, people go on shooting sprees every day, terrorists blow up airport and train stations, psychopaths run for president, and spoiler alert series, they win as well. That's basically tying in very much to this, well, kind of the attitude you see a lot on the internet that the world's going to hell and that someone should do something about it. And this guy is.
Okay.
So he kills his way through some gangsters. Then he takes off his hood and we see that actually he's quite a young looking man. And then it flashes back to how he got here, which is basically he's a guy called Dylan, who throughout his life has suffered from depression and anxiety issues. And eventually one day, basically when he found out that the girl he really likes is basically just hanging around with him because she feels sorry for him, he decides that enough's enough and he's going to take his own life. So he goes up to the top of his building, jumps off, but then ends up getting caught in some laundry lines.
This guy has no luck, does he?
He doesn't. You can almost hear the comedy, wah, wah, wah. So anyway, he's lying there in bed, realising that, you know, actually, no, he wants to live after all, when suddenly a demon appears. So it's this big, big scary black smoke monster yelling, okay, I'm actually the one who saved your life. And in return, you now have to kill one person a month or you'll die.
And this is a comic, right?
Hold on.
Yes,
this is
a comic.
Because it sounds like the plot from a manga.
It also sounds like a really poor deal. The demon has saved someone who was clearly trying to kill himself and says, kill one person a month or you will die. Surely the guy caught in the washing line is going to go, okay, no.
Well, no, but that's the thing. He now doesn't want to kill himself. Because in trying to kill himself, he realised that he actually really wants to live.
Isn't that always the way?
It is, isn't it? So at first, Dylan refuses. He says, no, you're obviously not real. You're just some hallucination I'm having, like from the stress of trying to kill myself. And then the demon breaks his arm.
If you're trying to convince people that you are real, breaking their arm, I find, is the most expedient way of doing it.
Would think so. Or does it?
Dun, dun, dun!
Because it's also entirely possible that Dylan broke his arm when he jumped off the roof.
This is true.
And that was just the point that the adrenaline wore off and he could actually start feeling it.
Again, true.
And it could be that this demon saying, you need to start killing people, is actually tying back to what he was saying at the start of the series about this whole, the world's gone to hell and someone needs to start doing something about it.
This Dylan fella's a hard guy to convince, isn't he?
He is, he is, isn't he? But regardless, towards the end of the issue, he starts feeling more and more sick, to the point that like the demon shows up again and says, this is it, you're starting to die, you need to kill someone within the next few days, or that's it. And I like that there's like even a bit where basically he says, I wish I could say that it took me a long time to decide I was going to do it, but like it didn't, like it takes me kind of just a minute to think, yeah, okay, I'll start killing people.
Wow.
And the issue ends with him saying, no, I just had to find someone who deserved to die and kill them. How hard could that be? So yeah, I've got to admit, it's a series that's got me hooked. It's a very interesting setup. Like, it's not particularly original, the whole maybe it's a demon, maybe it's all in his head. But I think this does it in a really good way, especially because kind of either possibility is equally terrifying. Either there's a scary demon that wants people to start doing murders, or there's this clearly mentally unstable guy who wants to set the world to rights. And kind of both of those, they are interesting scenarios that I want to read more about.
Excellent.
So yeah, I would give it 3 Nightwing butts, and then also a Midnighter butt, because he's kind of like Nightwing, but a crazy vigilante.
No Nighthawk butts then.
Actually, that can be... I've got it. When we've got bad series, instead of just giving them a low number of Nightwing butts, we give them a high number of Nighthawk butts.
I can see that leading to some confusion.
Yeah, same here.
Okay, then we'll just cut out the Nighthawk butt system, because literally no one cares about Nighthawk. That's why his comic book got cancelled.
Maybe we just award them a Nighthawk.
Yeah, it can be like our version of the Razzies.
Yeah.
Sounds fair to me.
So, for example, today, Marvel have earned themselves a Nighthawk.
They have.
Yes. Mick, was the Black Sinister from Image as well, or...?
No, it was Dark Horse.
I was going to say.
Oh, okay, so it's just, you mentioned Image while you were talking about... You confused me, Mick. You tricked me with your devious lies.
I know. And when I start my new job at Marvel, you can thank me for it, because I'll have practiced it on you first.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
For my part, the Autumn Lands...
I'm thinking that allying with literal weapon smugglers is a good idea.
Well, he is a corporate shill.
I am.
And he freely admits it.
I do. Stick to your strengths, that's what I say.
Okay, moving on to me for the big finale. And I've had an animal theme running today. And that hasn't changed because I've got Garth Ennis's Rover Red Charlie. Now, you guys probably know Garth Ennis... more as...
Yeah, I've heard of Garth Ennis, but that's yes. Like the only thing from that sentence.
No. I was talking to the audience. I was talking to the listeners, not you two.
We are the listeners as well. We are our own customers.
There is no audience in Japan. It's just me and Mick.
In fairness, Rob, it's probably the time that we should break it to you. We're actually just voices in your head.
No, you can't be the voices in my head. You say nicer things.
Also, I'd like to say that is well-timed on the ice cream truck behind, I assume, Rob. They kicked in just as Mick made that dramatic revelation.
It wasn't me. It's on Mick's, side, I think, is the ice cream truck.
Okay, but either way, it was just great. Yeah. Rob, we're in your head.
Anyway, Garth Ennis is the guy who wrote Preacher and Crossed, so if any of the listeners have never heard of them, they'll probably heard of him. They'll probably heard of Preacher, at least, because it's got TV series as well. The artist for this is Michael DePasquale, and This Rover Red Charlie, right? It sounds like some kind of cord, doesn't it? But it's not.
It does.
Yeah, it's not actually, though. Rover Red Charlie are the name of three dogs. One's called Rover, one's called Red, and one's called Charlie. And this, right, this is set at the end of the world. Literally at the end of the world. Humans have basically, the dogs, this is actually a story told from the dog's perspective, and this is one of the reasons why I love it, because there's a book that I absolutely adore called Tail Chaser's Song, and it's a fantasy adventure about cats, but told from the perspective of cats. And this is kind of the same thing. It's a post-apocalyptic horror told from the perspective of dogs. And the dogs are basically dogs. They've got the honesty and that loyalty and also that kind of, innocence that dogs tend to have. And I say innocence rather than stupidity because there are stupid dogs in this as well. And so dogs generally call humans the feeders. You know, they regard humans as kind of these godlike beings that give them a place to live and give them food that's tasty and look after them and, you know, care for them and love them. And the dogs give the feeders their love. But something's happened to the feeders. The feeders have gone crazy from the dog's perspective. And the feeders are killing each other and killing themselves at the same time. Everybody has just gone nuts. And so the world is collapsing around these three dogs, and these three dogs are friends. Rover and Red and Charlie are friends. And so it starts off with Charlie, who's kind of he's a guide dog. And his owner has basically burned himself alive, and Charlie is still held in the death grip of his owner. His leash is still held. And Rover and Red come to rescue him along with another dog. And they're basically chew through the leash, and they all four of them escape, but the other dog, unfortunately, is caught by a crazy human who basically kills him, unfortunately. And there is a lot of dog death in this. There's a lot of human death, lots of animal death, lots of dog death in this. So if you're an animal lover, this is not the series for you.
Yeah, I was going to say, human deaths in all our series are completely fine to gloss over, but animal deaths need to come with a warning.
Yeah. So the thing is, with this, somehow Garth Ennis has managed to capture the essence of dogness in these dogs. And I know that sounds a bit weird, but when you read this, you just think dogs do behave like that. I mean, Red has this thing. Every dog he meets, he'll say, "How does my ass smell?" And the dogs will say, you know, "Awesome." And Rover and Charlie will keep telling Red off, saying, "We don't have time for that, Red." And, you know, because they're in the middle of this apocalypse. They get ambushed by cats on a bridge, and the cats are basically hungry, and they're going to eat the dogs. And the dogs manage to get their own back on the cats by drowning them in the river. So, cats drowning in rivers. Yeah.
Okay.
This is all very brutal, but it's animal-on-animal violence. You know, it's not humans being violent to the animals. There's one kind of horrific and tragic bit where you have this big kind of fighting dog that's basically been trained to do all sorts of horrible things by humans, which kind of shows the dark side of humans towards animals. But generally, Rover, Red, and Charlie, they're these upbeat and a little bit dumb dogs. Charlie has it in his head that they have to be more like the cats. The cats were aware of what was going on and basically got out of Dodge very early on. And so the dogs have to be more like the cats. They have to think and they have to learn. And the story moves on. Anyway, I was talking about Red and his fascination with his own backside. There's one glorious bit where they've got this little dachshund or something like that. And it's sniffing Red's butt, but it's more like he's a wine taster or something like that. He's getting hints of Tabasco and these floral notes to finish and stuff like that. I'm like, as soon as I read that bit, I almost collapsed because it was just so perfect. But so, you know, it just came in at a totally obscure time.
You're thinking about it. Lots of sickening violence and lots of characters talking about butts basically describes every one of Garth Ennis's comics.
Exactly.
To be fair, it also describes an edition of four panel.
That is also true.
It is.
You guys should really stop talking about Nightwing's butt so much.
Hey, I didn't. Well, actually, I kind of did start that, didn't I? But yeah,
I mean, you know that now. All I'm thinking about is what does it smell like?
Although, to be fair, I think that says more about you than it does about either of us.
Yeah.
For science.
I mean, just this dog that they find, just to give you what he says. He says, I'm getting nutmeg, cinnamon, notes of Tabasco, subtle, very subtle, yet lingering, and a long, rich, complex finish. All in all, remarkable. You are to be congratulated, sir. And when I read that, I was just kind of, that's just so wrong, but it's so perfect. Because dogs go around sniffing other dogs' butts. It's true, though, isn't it?
It is.
And there's another great bit, because Red is basically Clifford, right, in this. Red is supposed to be Clifford, the big red dog. He's basically a big red dog who's a bit dumb and stupid and tends to get into accidents, but he's also exceptionally loyal to the ones that he cares about. And so there's this fascination with his butt, but there's also one bit, because Rover and Charlie have been fixed by their feeders, right? But Red hasn't, and so Red sees a border collie in heat, and the first thing he does is run up to her, and Rover's going, what the hell are you doing, Red? At least ask her first.
Yep, this is definitely a Garth Ennis comic.
Yeah, I can also see why it appealed to Rob.
Well, it's...
Oh, look at that, we're at the end of the show.
Yeah, all I'm saying is, if you're a Garth Ennis fan, then Rover Red Charlie is worth a read. And if you just like, if you're after something that deals with kind of a post-apocalyptic world, but from a different perspective, then it's worth a look.
And if you like dogs, maybe not.
Or maybe yes. It shows dogs in a good light and a bad light.
I mean, as well, I imagine there's quite a few dog lovers for whom comic in which dogs are brutally murdered.
Yeah, probably not for them.
It's not ideal.
Probably not for them, you know. It's a good story. This is the thing. It's kind of, The Journey Home? That one where the animals have to cross America? It's kind of like that, but with a little bit of Mad Max thrown in. In fact, a lot of Mad Max thrown in.
No, it does actually sound quite good.
It is
just
very,
from the description,
good.
I would give Garth Ennis a ruffle on the head and a, who's a good boy?
Yes, and I would definitely give this four Nightwing butts and one cheek.
Well, that's very nearly four and a half Nightwing butts.
Surely that is four and a half.
It is.
I don't know. Does
unless does, you're saying does, one of Nightwing's cheeks is bigger than the other.
Does the cleft count as a separate part of the butt in itself?
No, that's the separator.
Yeah, because surely the cleft is nothing but an absence of butt.
Yes.
In a way, we are all the cleft.
But in essence, isn't it the functional part of said butt?
God, this is an ethical conundrum we've stumbled upon.
Isn't it? I think I possibly need a week to mull that over.
All I know is that Rob's going to love editing this part of the show.
The next time we see him, he'll be a broken man.
Exactly.
Again.
So, anyway, to answer Andrew's question, I don't know what Nightwing's butt smells like, but I'm sure some of our listeners will have their own opinions. And if you have an opinion about what Nightwing's butt smells like, then, you know, let us know.
I mean, send them to me. I'll read them. Make a database of what people think Nightwing's butt smells like.
Does it have floral notes with a complex finish?
And a whoosh of hollyhocks.
Notes of honey badger.
I imagine it's muskier than that.
Notes of honey badger. With the scent of daisies.
Oh.
Anyway, on that note, we are at the end of the show, so we're going to leave you for this week. Four Panel is part of the Geek Show Podcast Network, and all of our shows are available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and Audio Boom, or the podcast provider of your choice. We're also on Patreon, so if you're a regular listener, then please show your support. If you want to get in touch with us and answer any of our complex questions that we've asked today, then you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or email us studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. Please don't email us, because that goes straight to me. until next time, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been Mick.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.